be unwise to say such a thing to her. He wrote until dawn was coming up in the east, and then fell into bed and slept for 4 hours. His dreams were confused and unpleasant. In one of them, Annie's father was climbing a long flight of stairs. He had a basket of what appeared to be newspaper clippings in his arms. Paul tried to cry out to him, to warn him, but every time he opened his mouth, nothing came out but a neatly reasoned paragraph of narration. Although this paragraph was different each time he tried to scream, it always opened the same way. One day, about a week later, and now came Annie Wilkes, screaming, rushing down the hall, hands outstretched to give her father the killing push, only her screams were becoming weird buzzing noises, and her body was rippling and humping and changing under her skirt and cardigan sweater, because Annie was changing into a bee. No one official came by the following day, but lots of unofficial people showed up, designated gawkers. One of the cars was full of teenagers. When they turned into the driveway to reverse direction, Annie rushed out and screamed at them to get off her land before she shot them for the dirty dogs they were.
"Fuck off, dragon lady!"
one of them shouted.
"Where'd you bury him?"
another yelled as the car backed out in a boil of dust. A third threw a beer bottle. As the car roared away, Paul could make out a bumper sticker pasted to the rear window. "Support the Sidewinder Blue Devils," it read. An hour later, he saw Annie stalk grimly past his window, drawing on a pair of work gloves as she headed for the barn. She came back some time later with a chain. She had taken the time to interlace its stout steel loops with barbed wire. When this prickly knitting was padlocked across the driveway, she reached into her breast pocket and took out some red pieces of cloth. These she tied to several of the links to aid visibility.
"It won't keep the cops out," she said when she finally came in. "But it'll keep the rest of the brats away."
"Yes."
"Your hand. It looks swollen."
"Yes."
"I hate to be a cock-a-doody pest, Paul, but..."
"Tomorrow," he said.
"Tomorrow? Really?"
She brightened at once. "Yes, I think so. Probably around 6.
"Paul, that's wonderful. Shall I start reading now, or..."
"I'd prefer that you wait."
"Then I will."
That tender, melting look had crept into her eyes again. He had come to hate her most of all when she looked that way.
"I love you, Paul. You know that, don't you?"
"Yes," he said. "I know." And bent over his pad again. That evening she brought him his Keflex pill. His urinary infection was improving, but very slowly, and a bucket of ice. She laid a neatly folded towel beside it, and left without saying a word. Paul put his pencil aside. He had to use the fingers of his left hand to unbend the fingers of his right, and slipped his hand into the ice. He left it there until it was almost completely numb. When he took it out, the swelling seemed to have gone down a little. He wrapped the towel around it and sat, looking out into the darkness until it began to tingle. He put the towel aside, flexed the hand for a while. The first few times made him grimace with pain, but then the hand began to limber up and started to write again. At dawn, he rolled slowly over to his bed, lurched in, and was asleep at once. He dreamed he was lost in a snowstorm, only it wasn't snow. It was flying pages which filled the world, destroying direction, and each page was covered with typing, and all the N's and T's and E's were missing, and he understood that if he was still alive when the blizzard ended, he would have to fill them all in himself, by hand, deciphering words that were barely there. He woke up around 11, and almost as soon as Annie heard him stirring about, she came in with orange juice, his pills, and a bowl of hot chicken soup. She was glowing with excitement.
"It's a very special day, Paul, isn't it?"
"Yes." He tried to pick up the spoon with his right hand and could not. It was puffy and red. So swollen the skin was shiny.
When he tried to bend it into a fist, it felt as though long rods of metal had been pushed through it at random. The last few days, he thought, had been like some nightmare autographing session that just never ended.
"Oh, your poor hand," she cried. "I'll get you another pill. I'll do it right now."
"No. This is the push. I want my head clear for it."
"But you can't write with your hand like that."
"No," he agreed. "My hand's shot. I'm going to finish this baby the way I started, with that royal. 8 or 10 pages should see it through. I guess I can fight my way through that many N's, T's, and E's."
"I should have gotten you another machine," she said.
She looked honestly sorry. Tears stood in her eyes. Paul thought that the occasional moments like this were the most ghastly of all, because in them he saw the woman she might have been if her upbringing had been right, or the drugs squirted out by all the funny little glands inside her had been less wrong. Or both.
"I goofed. It's hard for me to admit that, but it's true. It was because I didn't want to admit that Dartmonger woman got the better of me. I'm sorry, Paul. Your poor hand."
She raised it, gentle as Niobe at the pool, and kissed it. "That's all right," he said. "We'll manage, Ducky Daddles and I. I hate him, but I've got a feeling he hates me as well, so I guess we're even."
"Who are you talking about?"
"The Royal. I've nicknamed it after a cartoon character."
"Oh."
She trailed away. Turned off. Came unplugged. He waited patiently for her to return, eating his soup as he did so, holding the spoon awkwardly between the first and second fingers of his left hand. At last she did come back and looked at him, smiling radiantly like a woman just awakening, and realizing it was going to be a beautiful day.
"Soup almost gone? I've got something very special if it is."
He showed her the bowl, empty except for a few noodles stuck to the bottom. "See what a doobie I am, Annie?" he said without even a trace of a smile.
"You're the most goodest doobie there ever was, Paul, and you get a whole row of gold stars. In fact, wait. Wait till you see this."
She left, leaving Paul to look first at the calendar and then at the Arc de Triomphe. He looked up at the ceiling and saw the interlinked W's waltzing drunkenly across the plaster. Last of all, he looked across at the typewriter and the vast, untidy pile of manuscript. "Goodbye to all that," he thought randomly. And then Annie was bustling back in with another tray. On it were 4 dishes, wedges of lemon on 1, grated egg on a 2nd, toast points on a 3rd. In the middle was a larger plate, and on this one was a vast, oogie, gooey pile of caviar.
"I don't know if you like this stuff or not," she said shyly. "I don't even know if I like it. I never had it."
Paul began to laugh. It hurt his middle and it hurt his legs, and it even hurt his hand. Soon he would probably hurt even more, because Annie was paranoid enough to think that if someone was laughing, it must be at her. But still he couldn't stop. He laughed until he was choking and coughing, his cheeks red, tears spurting from the corners of his eyes. The woman had cut off his foot with an axe and his thumb with an electric knife. And here she was with a pile of caviar big enough to choke a warthog. And for a wonder, that black look of crevasse did not dawn on her face. She began to laugh with him instead. Caviar was supposed to be one of those things you either loved or hated, but Paul had never felt either way. If he was flying first class and a stewardess stuck a plate of it in front of him, he ate it, and then forgot there was such a thing as caviar until the next time a stewardess stuck a plate of it in front of him. But now he ate it hungrily, with all the trimmings, as if discovering the great principle of food for the first time in his life. Annie didn't care for it at all. She nibbled at the 1 dainty teaspoonful she'd put on a toast point, wrinkled her face in disgust, and put it aside. Paul, however, plowed ahead with undimmed enthusiasm. In a space of 15 minutes, he had eaten half of Mount Beluga. He belched, covered his mouth, and looked guiltily at Annie, who went off into another gay gust of laughter. "I think I'm going to kill you, Annie," he thought, and smiled warmly at her. "I really do. I may go with you, probably will, in fact, but I'm going to go with a by-God belly full of caviar. Things could be worse." "That was great, but I can't eat any more," he said.
"You'd probably throw up if you did," she said. "That stuff is very rich."
She smiled back.
"There's another surprise. I have a bottle of champagne for later, when you finish the book. It's called Dom Perignon. It costs $75 for one bottle. But Chucky Yoder down at the liquor store says it's the best there is."
"Chucky Yoder is right," Paul said, thinking that it was partly Dom's fault that he had gotten himself into this hell in the first place. He paused a moment and then said, "There's something else I'd like as well, for when I finish."
"Oh, what's that?"
"You said once you had all of my things."
"I do."
"Well, there was a carton of cigarettes in my suitcase. I'd like to have a smoke when I finish." Her smile had faded slowly.
"You know those things are no good for you, Paul. They cause cancer."
"Annie, would you say that cancer is something I have to worry about just now?" She didn't answer. "I just want that one single cigarette. I've always leaned back and smoked one when I finished. It's the one that always tastes the best, believe me. Even better than the one you have after a really fine meal. At least that's how it used to be. I suppose this time it'll make me feel dizzy and like puking. But I'd like that little link with the past. What do you say, Annie? Be a sport."
"I have been." "All right. But before the champagne. I'm not drinking a $75 bottle of fizzy beer in the same room where you've been blowing that poison around."
"That's fine. If you bring it to me around noon, I'll put it on the windowsill where I can look at it once in a while. I'll finish, then I'll fill in the letters, and then I'll smoke it until I feel like I'm going to fall down unconscious, and then I'll butt it. Then I'll call you."
"All right," she said. "But I'm still not happy about it. Even if you don't get lung cancer from just one, I'm still not happy about it. And you know why, Paul?"
"No."
"Because only don't bees smoke," she said, and began to gather up the dishes.
"Mr. Boss, Ian. Is she?"
"Shh!" Ian hissed fiercely, and Hezekiah subsided. Geoffrey felt a pulse beating with wild rapidity in his throat. From outside came the steady, soft creak of lines and rigging, the slow flap of the sails and the first faint breezes of the freshening trade winds, the occasional cry of a bird. Dimly, from the afterdeck, Geoffrey could hear a gang of men singing a shanty in bellowing, off-key voices. But in here all was silence, as the three men, two white and one black, waited to see if misery would live. Or... Ian groaned hoarsely, and Hezekiah gripped his arm. Geoffrey merely tightened his already hysterically tight hold on himself. After all of this, could God really be cruel enough to let her die? Once he could have denied such a possibility, confidently, and with humor rather than indignation. The idea that God could be cruel would in those days have struck him as absurd. But his ideas about God, like his ideas about so many things, had changed. They had changed in Africa. In Africa he had discovered that there was not just one God, but many, and some were more than cruel. They were insane, and that changed all. Cruelty, after all, was understandable. With insanity, however, there was no arguing. If his misery were truly dead, as he had come to fear, He intended to go up on the foredeck and throw himself over the rail. He had always known and accepted the fact that the gods were hard. He had no desire, however, to live in a world where the gods were insane. These wretched musings were interrupted by a harsh, half-superstitious gasp from Hezekiah.
"Miss Boss, Ian! Miss Boss, Jeffrey! Look! She eyes! Look, she eyes!"
Misery's eyes, that gorgeously delicate shade of cornflower blue, had fluttered open. They passed from Ian to Jeffrey, and then back to Ian again. For a moment Jeffrey saw only puzzlement in those eyes, and then recognition dawned in them, and he felt gladness roar through his soul.
"Where am I?"
she asked, yawning and stretching.
"Ian, Jeffrey, are we at sea? Why am I so hungry?"
Laughing, crying, Ian bent and hugged her, speaking her name over and over again. Bewildered but pleased, she hugged him back, and because he knew she was all right, Jeffrey found he could abide their love, now and forever. He would live alone, could live alone, in perfect peace. Perhaps the gods were not insane after all, at least not all of them. He touched Ezekiel on the shoulder.
"I think we should leave them alone, old man, don't you?"
"I guess that'd be right, Mr. Boss Jeffrey,"
Ezekiel said. He grinned widely, flashing all seven of his gold teeth. Jeffrey stole one last look at her, and for just a moment those cornflower eyes flashed his way, warming him, filling him, fulfilling him. "I love you, my darling," he thought. "Do you hear me?" Perhaps the answer which came back was only the wistful call of his own mind, but he thought not. It was too clear, too much her own voice.
"I hear, and I love you too."
Jeffrey closed the door and went up to the afterdeck. Instead of throwing himself over the rail as he might have done, he lit his pipe and smoked a bowl of tobacco slowly, watching the sun go down behind that distant, disappearing cloud on the horizon, that cloud which was the coast of Africa. And then, because he could not stand to do otherwise, Paul Sheldon rolled the last page out of the typewriter and scrawled the most loved and hated phrase in the writer's vocabulary with a pen. The end. His swollen right hand had not wanted to fill in the missing letters, but he had forced it through the work nonetheless. If he wasn't able to work at least some of the stiffness out of it, he was not going to be able to carry through with this. When it was done, he put the pen aside. He regarded his work for a moment. He felt as he always did when he finished a book, queerly empty, let down, aware that for each little success he had paid a toll of absurdity. It was always the same, always the same, like toiling uphill through jungle and breaking out to a clearing at the top after months of hell, only to discover nothing more rewarding than a view of the freeway, with a few gas stations and bowling alleys thrown in for good behavior or something. Still, it was good to be done, always good to be done, good to have produced, good to have caused a thing to be. In a numb sort of way, he understood and appreciated the bravery of the act, of making little lives that weren't, creating the appearance of motion and the illusion of warmth. He understood, now finally, that he was a bit of a dullard at doing this trick, but it was the only one he knew, and if he always ended up doing it ineptly, he at least never failed to do it with love. He touched the pile of manuscript and smiled a little bit. His hand left the big pile of paper and stole to the single Marlborough she had put on the windowsill for him. Beside it was a ceramic ashtray, with a paddle-wheel excursion boat printed on the bottom, encircled by the words, "Souvenir of Hannibal, Missouri, Home of America's Storyteller." In the ashtray was a book of matches, but there was only one match in it, all she had allowed him. One, however, should be enough. He could hear her moving around upstairs. That was good. He would have plenty of time to make his few little preparations. Plenty of warning if she decided to come down before he was quite ready for her. Here comes the real trick, Annie. Let's see if I can do it. Let's see. Can I? He bent over, ignoring the pain in his legs, and began to work the loose section of baseboard out with his fingers. He called for her 5 minutes later and listened to her heavy, somehow toneless tread on the stairs. He had expected to feel terrified when things got to this point, and he was relieved to find he felt quite calm. The room was filled with a reek of lighter fluid. It dripped steadily from one side of the board which lay across the arms of the wheelchair.
"Paul, are you really done?"
she called down the length of hallway. Paul looked at the pile of papers sitting on the board beside the hateful royal typewriter. Lighter fluid soaked the stack.
"Well," he called back, "I did the best I could, Annie." "Wow! Oh, great gee, I can hardly believe it. After all this time. Just a minute, I'll get the champagne." "Fine."
He heard her cross the kitchen linoleum, knowing where each squeak was going to come the instant before it did come. "I am hearing all these sounds for the last time," he thought. And that brought a sense of wonder. And wonder broke the calm open like an egg. The fear was inside. But there was something else in there as well. He supposed it was the receding coast of Africa. The refrigerator door was opened, then banged shut. Here she came across the kitchen again. Here she came. He had not smoked the cigarette, of course. It still lay on the windowsill. It had been the match he wanted. That one single match. What if it doesn't light when you strike it? But it was far too late for such considerations. He reached over to the ashtray and picked up the matchbook. He tore out the single match. She was coming down the hallway now. Paul struck the match, and sure enough, it didn't light. Easy. Easy does it. He struck it again. Nothing. Easy. Easy. He scratched it along the rough dark brown strip on the back of the book a third time, and a pale yellow flame bloomed at the end of the paper stick.
"I just hope this—"
She stopped. The next word pulled back inside her as she sucked in breath. Paul sat in his wheelchair behind a barricade of heaped paper and ancient royal stenomongery. He had purposely turned the top sheet around so she could read this. "Misery's Return" by Paul Sheldon. Above this sopping pile of paper, Paul's swollen hand hovered, and held between the thumb and his first finger was a single burning match. She stood in the doorway, holding a bottle of champagne wrapped in a strip of toweling. Her mouth dropped open. She closed it with a snap. "Paul," cautiously, "what are you doing?" "It's done," he said. "And it's good, Annie. You were right. The best of the misery books, and maybe the best thing I ever wrote, mongrel or not. Now I'm going to do a little trick with it. It's a good trick. I learned it from you."
"Paul, no!"
she screamed. Her voice was full of agony and understanding. Her hands flew out, the bottle of champagne dropping from them unheeded. It hit the floor and exploded like a torpedo. Curds of foam flew everywhere.
"No. No, please don't."
"Too bad you'll never read it," Paul said, and smiled at her. It was his first real smile in months, radiant and genuine. False modesty aside, I've got to say it was better than good. It was great, Annie. The match was guttering, printing its small heat on the tips of his fingers. He dropped it. For one terrible moment, he thought it had gone out. And then pale blue fire uncoiled across the title page with an audible sound. Boomp. It ran down the sides, tasted the fluid that had pooled along the outer edge of the paper pile, and shot up yellow.
Oh, God, no!
Annie shrieked.
Not misery! Not misery! Not her! No, no!
Now her face had begun to shimmer on the far side of the flames. Want to make a wish, Annie? He shouted at her.
Want to make a wish, you fucking goblin? Oh, my God, oh, Bull, what are you doing?
She stumbled forward, arms outstretched. Now the pile of paper was not just burning, it was blazing. The gray side of the Royal had begun to turn black. Lighter fluid had pooled under it, and now pale blue tongues of flame shot up between the keys. Paul could feel his face baking, the skin tightening.
Not misery, she wailed. You can't burn misery, you cockatoony brat, you can't burn misery.
And then she did exactly what he had almost known she would do. She seized the burning pile of paper and wheeled about, meaning to run to the bathroom with it, perhaps, and douse it in the tub. When she turned, Paul seized the Royal, unmindful of the blisters its hot right side was printing on his already swollen right hand. He lifted it over his head. Little blue fire drops still fell from its undercarriage. He paid them no more mind than he paid the flare of pain in his back as he strained something there. His face was an insane grimace of effort and concentration. He brought his arms forward and down, letting the typewriter fly out of his hands. It struck her squarely in the center of her wide, solid back.
Help!
It was not a scream, but a vast, startled grunt. Annie was driven forward onto the floor with a burning stack of paper under her. Small bluish fires like spirit lanterns dotted the surface of the board which had served as his desk. Gasping, each breath smooth hot iron in his throat, Paul knocked it aside. He pushed himself up and tottered erect on his right foot. Annie was writhing and moaning. A lick of flame shot up through the gap between her left arm and the side of her body. She screamed. Paul could smell frying skin, burning fat. She rolled over, struggling to her knees. Most of the paper was on the floor now, either still burning or hissing to ruin in puddles of champagne, but Annie still held some, and it was still burning. Her cardigan sweater was burning, too. He saw green hooks of glass in her forearms. A larger shard poked out of her right cheek, like the blade of a tomahawk.
"I'm going to kill you, you lying cocksucker!" she said, and staggered toward him.
She knee-walked three steps toward him, and then fell over the typewriter. She writhed and managed to turn over halfway. Then Paul fell on her. He felt the sharp angles of the typewriter beneath her, even through her body. She screamed like a cat, writhed like a cat, and tried to claw out from under him like a cat. The flames were going out around them, but he could still feel savage heat coming off the twisting, heaving mound beneath him, and knew that at least some of her sweater and brassiere must be cooked onto her body. He felt no sympathy at all. She tried to buck him off. He held on, and now he was lying squarely on top of her, like a man who means to commit rape, his face almost on hers. His right hand groped, knowing exactly what it was looking for.
"Get off me!"
He found a handful of hot, cherry paper.
"Get off me!"
He crumpled the paper, squeezing flames out between his fingers. He could smell her. Cooked flesh, sweat, hate, madness.
"Get off me!"
she screamed, her mouth yawning wide, and he was suddenly looking into the dank, red-lined pit of the goddess.
"Get off me, you cock-a-doodie brat!"
He stuffed paper, white bond and black charred onion skin, into that gaping, screaming mouth. Saw the blazing eyes suddenly widen even more, now with surprise and horror and fresh pain.
Here's your book, Annie.
He panted, and his hand closed on more paper. This bunch was out, dripping wet, smelling sourly of spilt wine. She bucked and writhed under him. The salt dome of his left knee whammed the floor, and there was excruciating pain, but he stayed on top of her. I'm gonna rape you, all right, Annie. I'm gonna rape you because all I can do is the worst I can do. So suck my book. Suck my book. Suck on it until you fucking choke. He crumpled the wet paper with a convulsive closing jerk of his fist and slammed it into her mouth, driving the half-charred first bunch farther down. Here it is, Annie. How do you like it? It's a genuine first. It's the Annie Wilkes edition. How do you like it? Eat it, Annie. Suck on it. Go on and eat it. Be a doobie and eat your book all up. He slammed in a third wad, a fourth. The fifth was still burning. He put it out with the already blistered heel of his right hand as he stuffed it in. Some weird, muffled noise was coming out of her. She gave a tremendous jerk, and this time Paul was thrown off. She struggled and flailed to her knees. Her hands clawed at her blackened throat, which had a hideously swelled look. Little was left of her sweater but the charred ring of the neck. The flesh of her belly and diaphragm bubbled with blisters. Champagne was dripping from the wad of paper which protruded from her mouth. Annie croaked. She got to her feet somehow, still clawing at her throat. Paul pushed himself backward, legs sticking untidily out in front of him, watching her warily.
Move!
She took one step toward him. Two. Then she tripped over the typewriter again. As she fell this time, her head twisted at an angle, and he saw her eyes looking at him with an expression that was questioning and somehow terrible. What happened, Paul? I was bringing you champagne, wasn't I? The left side of her head connected with the edge of the mantelpiece, and she went down like a loose sack of bricks, striking the floor in a vast tumble that shook the house. Annie had fallen on the bulk of the burning paper. Her body had put it out. It was a smoking black lump in the middle of the floor. The puddles of champagne had put out most of the individual pages, but two or three had wafted against the wall to the left of the door, while still burning brightly, and the wallpaper was alight in spots, but burning with no real enthusiasm. Paul crawled over to his bed, pulling himself on his elbows, and got hold of the coverlet. Then he worked his way over to the wall, pushing the shards of broken bottle out of his way with the sides of his hands as he went. He had strained his back. He had burned his right hand badly. His head ached. His stomach roiled with a sick sweet smell of burned meat. But he was free. The goddess was dead, and he was free. He got his right knee under him, reached up clumsily with a coverlet, which was damp with champagne and striped with smeary black swaths of ash, and began to beat at the flames. When he let the coverlet fall into a smoking heap at the baseboard, there was a big smoking bald spot in the middle of the wall, but the paper was out. The bottom page of the calendar had curled up, but that was all. He began to crawl back toward the wheelchair. He was halfway there when Annie opened her eyes. Paul stared, unbelieving, as she got slowly to her knees. Paul himself was propped on his hands, legs trailing out behind him. He looked like a strange adult version of Popeye's nephew, Sweet Pea. No. No, you're dead. You are in error, Paul. You can't kill the goddess. The goddess is immortal. Now I must rinse. Her eyes were staring, horrible. A huge wound, pink-red, glared through her hair on the left side of her head. Blood sheeted down her face.
No!
Annie cried through her throatful of paper. She began to crawl toward him, hands outstretched, flexing.
Oh, no!
Paul pulled himself around in a half-circle and began to crawl for the door. He could hear her behind him. And then, as he entered the zone of broken glass, he felt her hand close around his left ankle and squeeze his stump excruciatingly. He screamed.
"Dirt!"
Annie cried triumphantly. He looked over his shoulder. Her face was turning slowly purple and seemed to be swelling. He realized she actually was turning into the Burka's idol. He yanked with all his might and his legs slithered footlessly out of her grasp, leaving her with nothing but the circlet of leather with which she had capped the stump. He crawled on, beginning to cry, sweat pouring down his cheeks. He pulled himself along on his elbows like a soldier advancing beneath heavy machine gun fire. He heard the thud of first one knee from behind him, then the other, then the first again. She was still coming. She was as solid as he had always feared. He had burned her, broken her back, stuffed her tubes full of paper, and still, still, still she was coming.
"Bert!"
Annie screamed now.
"Bert!"
One of his elbows came down on a hook of glass, and it jabbed up into his arm. He crawled forward anyway, with it sticking out of him like a pushpin. Her hand closed over his left calf.
"Oh, go out!"
He turned back again, and yes, her face had gone black, a dusky, rotted plum black from which her bleeding eyes bulged wildly. Her pulsing throat had swelled up like an inner tube, and her mouth was writhing. She was, he realized, trying to grin. The door was just in reach. Paul stretched out and laid hold of the jamb in a death grip.
"Go out there!"
Her right hand on his right thigh. Thud. One knee. Thud. The other. Closer. Her shadow. Her shadow falling over him.
"No,"
he whimpered. He felt her tugging, pulling. He held on to the jam grimly, eyes now squeezed shut. Over him, thunder. Goddess thunder. Now her hands scuttled up his back like spiders and settled upon his neck.
Dirt!
His air was gone. He held the jam. He held the jam and felt her over him, felt her hand sinking into his neck, and he screamed,
"Die, can't you die? Can't you ever die? Can't you?" "Go!"
The pressure slackened. For a moment he could breathe again. Then Annie collapsed on top of him, a mountain of slack flesh, and he couldn't breathe at all. He worked his way out from under her like a man burrowing his way out of a snowslide. He did it with the last of his strength. He crawled through the door, expecting her hand to settle around his ankle again at any moment, but that did not happen. Annie lay silent and face down in blood and spilled champagne and fragments of green glass. Was she dead? She must be dead. Paul did not believe she was dead. He slammed the door shut. The bolt she had put on looked like something halfway up a high cliff, but he clawed his way up to it, shot it, and then collapsed in a shuddery huddle at the door's foot. He lay in a stupor for some unknown length of time. What roused him from it was a low, minute scratching sound. "The rats," he thought. "It's the rat." Then Annie's thick, blood-grimed fingers poked under the door and tugged mindlessly at his shirt. He shrieked and jerked away from them, his left leg creaking with pain. He hammered at the fingers with his fist. Instead of pulling back, they jerked a little and lay still. "Let that be the end of her. Please, God, let that be the end of her." In horrible pain now, Paul began to crawl slowly back toward the bathroom. He got halfway there and looked back. Her fingers were still poking out from under the door. As bad as the pain was, he could not stand to look at that or even think of that. And so he reversed direction, went back, and pushed them under. He had to nerve himself to do it. He was certain that the moment he touched them, they would clutch him. He finally reached the bathroom, every part of him throbbing. He pulled himself inside and shut the door. God, what if she's moved the dope? But she hadn't. The untidy litter of boxes was still there, including the ones containing the sample packets of Novril. He took three dry, then crawled back to the door and lay down against it, blocking it with the weight of his body. Paul slept. When he woke up, it was dark, and at first he didn't know where he was. How had his bedroom gotten so small? Then he remembered everything, and with his remembering, a queer certainty came. She was not dead. Even now, not dead. She was standing right outside the door. She had the axe, and when he crawled out, she would amputate his head. It would go rolling off down the hallway like a bowling ball while she laughed. That is crazy, he told himself. And then he heard, or thought he did, a little rustling sound. The sound of a woman's starched skirt, perhaps, brushing lightly against the wall. You just made it up. Your imagination. It's so vivid. I didn't. I heard it. He hadn't. He knew that. His hand reached for the doorknob, then fell uncertainly back. Yes, he knew he had heard nothing. But what if he had? She could have gone out the window. Paul, she's dead. The return, implacable in its illogic. The goddess never dies. He realized he was frantically biting his lips and made himself stop it. Was this what going crazy was like? Yes. He was close to that, and who had a better right? But if he gave in to it, if the cops finally returned tomorrow or the day after to find Annie dead in the guest room and a blubbering ball of protoplasm in the downstairs bathroom, a blubbering ball of protoplasm who had once been a writer named Paul Sheldon, wouldn't that be Annie's victory? You bet. And now, Paulie, you're going to be a good little doobie and follow the scenario, right? Okay. His hand reached for the knob again, and faltered again. He couldn't follow the original scenario. In it, he had seen himself lighting the paper and her picking it up. That had happened. Only he was to have bashed her brains in with a fucking typewriter instead of hitting her in the back with it. Then he had meant to work his way out into the parlor and light the house on fire. The scenario had called for him to effect his escape through one of the parlor windows. He would take a hell of a thump, but he'd already seen how fastidious Annie was about locking her doors. Better thumped than crisped, as he believed John the Baptist had once said. In a book, all would have gone according to plan. But life was so fucking untidy. What could you say for an existence where some of the most crucial conversations of your life took place when you needed to take a shit or something? An existence where there weren't even any chapters. Very untidy, Paul croaked. Good thing there's guys like me, just to keep things rinsed, he cackled. The champagne bottle hadn't been in the scenario, but that was minor compared with a woman's hideous vitality and his current painful uncertainty. And until he knew whether or not she was dead, he couldn't burn the house down, making a beacon that would bring help on the run. Not because Annie might still be alive. He could roast her alive with no qualms at all. It wasn't Annie that was holding him back. It was the manuscript. The real manuscript. What he had burned had been nothing more than an illusion with a title page on top. Blank pages interspersed with written rejects and culls. The actual manuscript of Misery's return had been safely deposited under the bed. And there it still was. Unless she's alive. If she's alive, maybe she's in there reading it. So what are you going to do? Wait right in here, part of him advised. Right in here where it's nice and safe. But another braver part of him urged him to go through with the scenario. As much of it as he could, anyway. Get to the parlor. Break the window. Get out of this awful house. Work his way to the edge of the road and flag down a car. Under previous circumstances, this might have meant waiting for days, but not anymore. Annie's house had become a drawing card. Summoning all of his courage, he reached for the doorknob and turned it. The door swung slowly open on darkness. And yes, there was Annie. There was the goddess, standing there in the shadows, a white shape in a nurse's uniform. He blinked his eyes tightly shut and then opened them. Shadows, yes. Annie, no. Except in the newspaper photographs, he had never seen her in her nurse's uniform. Only shadows. Shadows and, so vivid, imagination. He crawled slowly into the hall and looked back down toward the guest room. It was shut, blank, and he began to crawl toward the parlor. It was a pit of shadows. Annie could be hidden in any of them. Annie could be any of them. And she could have the axe. He crawled. There was the overstuffed sofa, and Annie was behind it. There was the kitchen door standing open, and Annie was behind that. The floorboards creaked in back of him. Of course. Annie was behind him. He turned, heart hammering, brain squeezing at his temples. And Annie was right there, all right. The axe upraised, but only for a second. She blew apart into shadows. He crawled into the parlor, and that was when he heard the drone of an approaching motor. A faint wash of headlights illuminated the window, brightened. He heard the tires skid in the dirt, and understood they had seen the chain she had strung across the driveway. A car door opened and shut.
Shit! Look at this!
He crawled faster, looked out, and saw a silhouette approaching the house. The shape of the silhouette's hat was unmistakable. It was a state cop. Paul groped on the knick-knack table, knocking figurines over. Some fell to the floor and shattered. His hand closed around one, and that at least was like a book. It held the roundness novels delivered precisely because life so rarely did. It was the penguin sitting on his block of ice. "Now my tale is told," the legend on the block read, and Paul thought, "Yes. Thank God." Propped on his left arm, he made his right hand close around the penguin. Blisters broke open, dribbling pus. He drew his arm back and heaved the penguin through the parlor window, just as he had thrown an ashtray through the window of the guest bedroom not so long ago.
"Here!" Paul Sheldon cried deliriously. "Here, in here! Please, I'm in here!"
There was yet another novelistic roundness in this denouement. They were the same two cops who had come the other day to question Annie about Kushner, David and Goliath. Only tonight David's sport coat was not only unbuttoned, his gun was out. David turned out to be Wicks. Goliath was McKnight. They had come with a search warrant. When they finally broke into the house in answer to the frenzied screams coming from the parlor, they found a man who looked like a nightmare sprung to life. "There was a book I read when I was in high school," Wicks told his wife early the next morning. "Count of Monte Cristo, I think. Or maybe it was The Prisoner of Zenda. Anyway, there was a guy in that book who'd spent 40 years in solitary confinement. He hadn't seen anybody in 40 years. That's what this guy looked like." Wicks paused for a moment, wanting to better express how it had been, the conflicting emotions he had felt, horror and pity and sorrow and disgust. Most of all, wonder that a man who looked this bad should still be alive. He could not find the words. When he saw us, he started to cry, he said, and finally added, "He kept calling me David. I don't know why." "Maybe you look like somebody he knew," she said. "Maybe so." Paul's skin was gray, his body rack-thin. He huddled by the occasional table, shivering all over, staring at them with rolling eyes.
"Who?"
McKnight began. "Goddess," the scrawny man on the floor interrupted. He licked his lips. "You have to watch out for her. Bedroom. That's where she kept me. Bet Ryder. Bedroom. She's there." "Annie Wilkes. Wicks. In that bedroom?" He nodded toward the hall. "Yes. Yes, locked in. But of course, there's a window."
"Who?"
McKnight began a second time.
"Christ, can't you see?"
Wicks asked. "It's the guy Kushner was looking for. The writer. Can't remember his name, but it's him."
"Thank God,"
the scrawny man said.
"What?"
Wicks bent toward him, frowning.
"Thank God you can't remember my name."
"I'm not tracking you, buddy."
"It's all right. Never mind. Just you have to be careful. I think she's dead. But be careful. If she's still alive, dangerous like a rattlesnake."
With tremendous effort, he moved his twisted left leg directly into the beam of McKnight's flashlight.
"Cut off my foot. Axe."
They stared at the place where his foot wasn't for long, long seconds, and then McKnight whispered,
"Good Christ."
"Come on," Wick said. He drew his gun, and the two of them started slowly down the hall to Paul's closed bedroom door.
"Watch out for her,"
Paul shrieked in his cracked and broken voice.
"Be careful."
They unlocked the door and went in. Paul pulled himself against the wall and leaned his head back, eyes closed. He was cold. He couldn't stop shivering. They would scream or she would scream. There might be a scuffle. There might be shots. He tried to prepare his mind for either. Time passed, and it seemed to be a very long time indeed. At last he heard booted feet coming back down the hall. He opened his eyes. It was Wicks.
"She was dead,"
Paul said.
"I knew it. The real part of my mind did. But I can still hardly believe..."
Wick said, "There's blood and broken glass and charred paper in there. But there's no one in that room at all." Paul Sheldon looked at Wicks, and then he began to scream. He was still screaming when he fainted. Four. Goddess.
"You will be visited by a tall, dark stranger,"
the gypsy woman told Misery. And Misery, startled, realized two things at once. This was no gypsy, and the two of them were no longer alone in the tent. She could smell Gwendolyn Chastain's perfume in the moment before the madwoman's hands closed around her throat. "In fact," the gypsy who was not a gypsy observed, "I think she is here now." Misery tried to scream, but could no longer even breathe. Misery's child.
It always looked that way, Boss Ian, Ezekiel said. No matter how you look at her, she seemed like she's looking at you. I don't know if it be true, but the Borkas, they say even when you get behind her, the goddess, she seemed to be looking at you. But she is, after all, only a piece of stone, Ian remonstrated.
Yes, Boss Ian.
Ezekiel agreed.
That would give her her power.
Misery's return.
Number one. You're number one. Fayon.
These sounds, even in the haze. Now I must rinse, she said. And this is how it rinses out. 9 months after Wicks and McKnight carried him from Annie's house on a makeshift litter, Paul Sheldon was dividing his time between Doctor's Hospital in Queens and a new apartment on the east side of Manhattan. His legs had been rebroken. His left was still in a cast from the knee down. He would walk with a limp for the rest of his life, the doctors told him, but he would walk. And eventually he would walk without pain. His limp would have been deeper and more pronounced if he had been walking on his own foot instead of a custom-made prosthesis. In an ironic sort of way, Annie had done him a favor. He was drinking too much and not writing at all. His dreams were bad. When he got out of the elevator on the 9th floor one afternoon in May, he was for a change thinking not of Annie, but of the bulky package tucked clumsily under his arm. It contained 2 bound galleys of Misery's return. His publishers had put the book on a very fast track, and considering the worldwide headlines generated by the bizarre circumstances under which the novel had been written, that was hardly surprising. Hastings House had ordered an unprecedented first printing of 1,000,000 copies. "That's only the beginning," Charlie Merrill, his editor, had told him at lunch that day. The lunch from which Paul was now returning with his bound galleys. "This book is going to outsell everything in the world, my friend. We all just ought to be down on our knees, thanking God that the story in the book is almost as good as the story behind the book." Paul didn't know if that was true, and didn't really care anymore. He only wanted to get it behind him and find the next book. But as dry days became dry weeks, became dry months, he had begun to wonder if there ever would be a next book. Charlie was begging him for a non-fiction account of his ordeal. That book, he said, would outsell even Misery's Return. Would, in fact, outsell Iacocca. When Paul asked him out of idle curiosity what he thought the paperback rights for such a book might fetch, Charlie brushed his long hair away from his forehead, lit a Camel, and said, "I believe we could set a floor at $10 million and then conduct one hell of an auction." He did not bat an eye when he said it. After a moment or two, Paul realized he either was serious or thought he was. But there was no way he could write such a book. Not yet. Probably not ever. His job was writing novels. He could write the account Charlie wanted, but to do so would be tantamount to admitting to himself that he would never write another novel. And the joke is, it would be a novel, he almost said to Charlie Merrill, and then held back at the last moment. The joke was, Charlie wouldn't care. "It would start out as fact, and then I'd begin to tart it up. Just a little at first. Then a little more. Then a little more. Not to make myself look better, although I probably would. And not to make Annie look worse. She couldn't. Simply to create that roundness. I don't want to fictionalize myself. Writing may be masturbatory, but God forbid it should be an act of auto-cannibalism." His apartment was 9E, farthest from the elevator, and today the corridor looked 2 miles long. He began to stump his way grimly down.